This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Another big event is underway in San Jose that we wanted to talk about in this half-hour segment. It's a celebration of the bicentennial of Mexico's revolution, and nearly every cultural and educational institution in the South Bay is marking the day with concerts and art exhibits and lectures and a tequila expo. In this half-hour, we want to explore the art and the artifacts and the literature of Mexico and the revolution, and I ought to mention that there is a joint project that will be presented by the Bancroft Library in Berkeley and the Stanford Library Special Collection. There's about 160 images from the Bancroft Library and 120 from the Stanford Library. And some of these are very arresting images. They really have to do with Mexican identity and with the history of Grito de Dolores, Father Miguel Hidalgo, who started the call to arms back in 1810 and the War of Independence from Spain. And then we have the 1910 Social Revolution over land reform and equity. And also the first Mexican Constitution in 1824, which was a copy that was actually acquired from an Argentinian book dealer. So there's all of this history, as well as literature and art, that's embedded in this festival. And we're fortunate enough to have a couple of people here to talk with us about art and artifacts and some of these images and the literature. Aidan Griego is curator for Latin American, Mexican American, and Iberian collections at Stanford. He co-authored the new exhibit, which is called Celebrating Mexico, the Grito de Dolores and the Mexican Revolution, 1810, 1910, 2010. It's a collaboration, as I said, between Stanford and UC Berkeley, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We are glad to have you. We're also glad to have Juan Velasco, who's here with us in studio. He's an associate professor of English at Santa Clara University, specializes in Latin America and Chicano-Chicana literature, and is giving a lecture, The Novels of the Mexican Revolution as Part of Shared Heritage, Mexico and California 200 Years Program. And welcome to our program.
Thank you. It is wonderful to be here.
And it's delightful to have you here. And Aidan Griego, let me begin with you, if I may, to get the picture of just what's in this collection. Looking at a manifesto from Zapata, we're looking at a wanted poster of Pancho Villa. We're looking at some pretty extraordinary things.
Certainly. As you mentioned, it's a joint exhibit by the Bancroft Library and the Stanford University Libraries, and we have about 300 items on display. And I'll start by mentioning some of the items that the Bancroft Library has that are actually quite interesting. There's a wanted poster for Pancho Villa. As you know, Pancho Villa invaded the United States in 1916 staging a raid in Columbus, New Mexico. And he went from being a kind of Robin Hood character in the United States thanks to John Reed's insurgent Mexico, who had spent 4 months embedded in Pancho Villa with Pancho Villa's troops in Mexico. We also have...
Excuse me, just for the record, this was from the Pershing exhibition, and I just want to mention as a historical footnote, he was ordered, captured by President Woodrow Wilson, was he not?
Certainly, President Wilson was, as you can expect, very upset or very angry that Pancho Villa had invaded the United States, and he ordered General John J. Pershing to pursue Pancho Villa deep into Mexico. Of course, Pancho Villa was never captured. He managed to escape by hiding in the caves of the High Sierras of Chihuahua, and he became more of a legendary hero than he already was. And John J. Pershing managed to salvage his fame by going to Europe as the supreme commander of the Allied troops in the First World War.
I believe that's correct. So what else? We also have some lithographs by an Italian artist.
There are some lithographs, and they are probably the closest thing that we would have as real pictures of Miguel Hidalgo, the father of Mexican independence, and Father Morelos, the other rebel leader from the early Wars of Independence. Claudio Linati was an Italian artist that came to Mexico in the late 1820s and did a lot of pictures of drawings of life at the period of the period, and those are probably the closest images that we have of what those two characters, legendary characters, would have looked like. Father Hidalgo, over the years, has been sort of been aggrandized as the father of the nation, and so he becomes very fatherly, very grandfatherly in many ways. But the depiction that Claudio Linati gives is very different than what we are accustomed to seeing.
Your webpage is up now, so people can see some of these images, isn't it?
They certainly can see the images that we have on display at our exhibit that opens officially on the 20th, which is Monday, but it's already up, so anybody who cannot come next week can certainly come and get a preview this week. The exhibit is free and open to the public anytime that Green Library, the main central library on campus, is open.
Bancroft is already open, yeah.
Bancroft's open on the 2nd of December, and I believe their hours are a little bit more limited because they are, after all, the Special Collections Library of UC Berkeley, and so their hours are public hours are a little bit more limited than our public collection.
Can you give the website for people who want to go see these images on the web?
Let me go. I believe it's a very long.
We'll get it for you. Don't worry,
yes.
And we'll put it out here. I want to get to some other questions though related to these images and what they convey. We're talking about art and artifacts, and not only about the revolution, but there's a great deal to learn about Mexican history and about Mexican identity, and particularly, I mean, for you, I know a lot of the concentration is on the immigration story, because back in 1910 and 1920, when most of the fighting occurred, you had, about 800,000 immigrants coming north?
There's probably closer to 900,000 people that were displaced because of the revolution and came to the United States. And one of the display cases that we have is devoted to immigration. We wanted to give a more personal touch to immigration. We have a postcard of anonymous refugees awaiting to be settled in a refugee camp in El Paso. But we also have photos of the family of Bay Area artist Esther Hernandez, whose family had to leave Mexico in 1917, come through El Paso and settle in the San Joaquin Valley where she was born. And also the grandmother of Juan Felipe Herrera, the great Chicano poet who nowadays resides in Riverside, whose grandmother also had to escape Mexico and came to El Paso in 1917.
As long as you're mentioning these literary artists, I'm going to bring Professor Velasco into the discussion, because in so much of Chicano and Chicana literature, there is this sense of, one's forebears and history. I mean, more so than many ethnic literatures.
This is very important in Mexican-American literature. I think if you go back to Mexico and ask some of the intellectuals and writers there, they might say that some of the promises of the Mexican Revolution were unfulfilled. And what is interesting is that with the spark of the Mexican-American civil rights movement in the 1960s, it feels like the Mexican-American population is able to take some of these images and some of these ideas and bring it forward. And some of those notions of hope and social justice and equality, it's been spread out into this magnificent literature. The novel that is considered the founder of contemporary Mexican-American literature, Pocho by José Antonio Villarreal, the first chapter is basically this magnificent scene where he reflects on his father's experience during the Mexican Revolution. And then from there on, Villarreal takes the character into his own reflection on his own experience as a Mexican-American in Santa Clara, California.
Yeah, even the word Pocho, I remember when there was a great deal of burgeoning of consciousness around La Raza, you know, Pocho and Cholo, and there was a whole sense of that invigorating feeling that came not only from discovering history, but even going back to the Aztecs, of course, but so much of the revolution was palpable in the work of many of these artists.
It's everywhere, and to me what is astonishing is that something that started in 1910, this whole reflection on Mexicanness, what does it mean to be Latin American at the beginning of the 20th century? What does it mean to be Mexican at the beginning of the 20th century? This is a very important debate. I think the intellectuals and writers of the Mexican Revolution, they were able to framed this dialogue in such an amazing way, you know, saying, how are we going to move forward without abandoning our traditions? How can we incorporate indigenous cultures and be a modern country? Well, some of those questions are still not being answered in Mexico or in Latin America, but a lot of those questions were being answered right here in California or in Texas or in New Mexico by the Mexican-American civil rights movement and the many writers that came out of it.
Yeah, and I was thinking just about the labor movement and Huelga, which had its ties also to the revolution, and Diego Rivera obviously had his. I mean, there's so much that goes back to the revolution. You mentioned Villarreal. What are the other works that really are the cornerstone of literature that is tied to the revolution historically?
Well, I live in San Jose, and for me, a person who was a very important labor organizer and scholar and writer, he wrote this wonderful autobiography titled Barrio Boy, Ernesto Galarza. In downtown San Jose, there is this beautiful monument to him. It's very simple and humble, but it's right there. And in the same way, I think Ernesto Galarza was able to tap into the narrative of Mexicans coming to the U.S., but also tapping into the connection with what is Mexican-American identity. And Barrio Boy is a very, very important book. I will also mention, when we talked about the novels of the Mexican Revolution, a lot of people know novels like The Underdogs by Mariano Azuela. It's a classic. But there are also very important women writers. And there is this beautiful writer. Her name is Nelly Campobello. And she wrote this novel of the revolution called Cartucho, Cartridge. And she tells the revolution from the perspective of a child. And it's very refreshing. And there are all kinds of literature still there that needs to be researched and brought into the open. And they're really, really interesting.
Juan Velasco is associate professor of English at Santa Clara University and specializes in Latin America and Chicano-Chicana literature. And Ed Griego is curator for the Latin American, Mexican, American, and Iberian collections. And
if I may add something related to what Professor Velasco has said. Barrio Boy by Ernesto Galarza is showcased in that display case on immigration. And Ernesto Galarza has a very close connection to Stanford. He got a doctorate. A master's degree at Stanford University. He was one of the first Chicano Latinos to attain a degree in higher education. And his papers are housed at the Stanford Libraries, and they're one of the most highly consulted materials in our special collections. And one of the other things that that Professor Velasco mentioned was some of the imagery that comes from the revolution into Chicano literature. And it even goes farther back than the revolution. It is the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe that appears in the United Farm Workers in the Cesar Chavez movement of the 1960s. And the Virgin of Guadalupe is very important in Mexican history as the Virgen Morena, the dark virgin that, according to tradition, appeared in Mexico in 1535. And Father Hidalgo was very conscious of the importance of the Virgin of Guadalupe as a national symbol. And in fact, he led his insurgent troops with the banner of the Virgin of Guadalupe. Spaniards had their own virgin, which was the Virgin Nuestra Señora de los Remedios, which I believe in English would be Our Lady of Remedies.
I was going to invite listeners to join us, which you can do toll-free, of course, if you have something you'd like to add to the conversation or question. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, as we're discussing the history and literature of the Mexican Revolution. And a real question for listeners might be, what does the Mexican Revolution mean to you, particularly if this is part of your heritage? You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I was also going to ask you, Juan Velasco said the importance of women and women writers in this is something that really needs to be factored in. I was struck by some of the images I saw of what were described as camp followers. We're talking about women soldiers, some of them really quite young, girls really, who were fighting.
Yes, they are.
They were called Adelita, I believe, in fact.
Yes, women had an important role in the revolution, and the term is called soldadera, or woman soldier, that sometimes is translated as camp follower. And I don't like the word camp follower because it's very passive, as if they just followed people around, but they actually were, they took arms. Adelita is a very famous song of the Mexican Revolution that chronicles this mujer valiente that fought along this, along people, the troops of Pancho Villa. And there's even a very famous, very interesting character in Emiliano Zapata, who was a revolutionary leader in the South. There is a woman who led life as a man. Her name was Amelia Robles, and she decided to be called Amelio Robles and managed to get recognition from the Mexican government as having been a Zapatista, part of the Zapatista troops, and as a man. He never got any monetary compensation, but certainly it must have been quite an exciting news to be recognized as a man, as El Coronel Amelio Robles. In literature, Professor Velasco mentions Nelly Campobello Cartucho. The novel Cartucho is displayed in its first edition, along a first edition of Mariano Azuela's Los de Abajo, or The Underdogs.
Let me ask Professor Velasco about some of the writers that many of our listeners may be familiar with, and I've been certainly familiar with for years. Well-known contemporary Mexican-American writers like Sandra Cisneros, probably the most famous, but mm-hmm. also some of the poets, Victor Hernandez Cruz and Gary Soto. These are poets who and writers who are also in many ways anchored in their consciousness in the revolution, are they not?
Absolutely. And I think what is exciting about the Mexican-American, the Chicano literature tradition is that it takes some of these images and some of these ideals forward. And some of the questions for the intellectuals at the beginning of the 20th century in Mexico City was, how are we going to be able to bring tradition, the history of Mexico, which is 3,000 years old, how are we going to bring tradition together with modernity? And this was a serious question, and I think they answered very appropriately, most of them. But in many ways, a lot of the promises and a lot of the ideals were really unfulfilled. And I think for these writers and for the Mexican-American experience, a lot of the accomplishments that we have seen here in Texas or in California or in New Mexico is that many of these writers and artists, they have been able to bring together modernity and tradition in very successful ways. And Sandra Cisneros is a wonderful example. But I can think also of the poet Pat Mora. She's a wonderful writer. And
I was also thinking of Maria Viramontes.
Maria Viramontes.
I find very compelling. Yeah.
So excellent collection of writers. And this goes back to that tradition of searching for freedom and a celebration of Mexican identity in what has been termed by many critics on the greater Mexico, not just the nation itself, but the greater region.
Let me go to your calls here. Anne has a question for us. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Okay. So the fact that this is supposedly related to independence, and yet immediately the speakers want to talk about the Mexican Revolution in 1910, a lot of Americans don't know anything about 1810 movement. And I will say, I lived in Casa Zapata, the Chicano theme house at Stanford, many years ago, and there was a lot of emphasis on the Mexican Revolution, but we learned absolutely nothing. The house never, ever wanted to talk about 1810 to 1825 at all, so I knew nothing about that. And I think I'd like to hear the speakers address this issue of why there's really almost nothing sort of in the Mexican-American, as far as I can tell, consciousness about the 1810 period. And I would contrast it very greatly with the American history tradition, where there's a lot of emphasis on the independence movement from England, of course, the so-called American Revolution, and how influential that was on the country. But as I say, living in this Chicana theme house, I got the sense that, you know, 1810 through 1825 or so had absolutely almost no impact intellectually or whatever on Mexican-American consciousness.
Well, thank you for that question, Anne. We should clarify that it's the bicentennial of the independence and 100th anniversary of the revolution. Mm-hmm. I don't know, either one of you can step up here. And did you want to say, Professor Velasco?
This is a very important question, because I think why didn't the 19th century spark the imagination of 20th century writers or even 21st century writers? And I think for intellectual and visual artists and cultural workers in general, the 19th century was a very, very difficult century. So 1810 celebrates the cry for freedom in Mexico. But Mexico will still have to go a long way to have cultural independence. And the 19th century has been accused of being very much influenced by other nations and invaded by other nations like France. So it won't be really until 1910, and this is my own personal opinion, that Mexico will have a real cultural revolution and cultural independence from European influence.
And let me also announce that we'll have a link to the images from Celebrating Mexico exhibit up later today on our website. Tim, let's get you on here. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, Professor Velasco and others, do you see there's something missing? I referred to the 1968 Olympic activities in Mexico City. Didn't government troops massacre hundreds of Mexicans? Yet on San Jose, in on the State University campus, There are these 9 or 10 foot black figures. They symbolize to some black power, to some Olympic triumph. But isn't there an imbalance there, as if they've been cut out from the context and space and time of where all this happened in Mexico City? Don't you find that artistically troubling?
Let me get Professor Velasco's response.
Yes. So 1910 sparks this movement for freedom, for social justice in Mexico. And then 1968, when I was referring before to Mexican intellectuals and writers, 1968, for many of these writers, it's really significant.
That's
because
a turning point. Really.
It's a turning point. Yeah. It's the end of the revolution. It's the end of the dream. It's the end of the hope. And talking about writers, I recommend to all the listeners to read Elena Poniatowska's Mexican, she's an amazing Mexican writer, the book on the killings of Tlatelolco.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Juan Velasco and Adán Griego. This is fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, we also mentioned John Reed before, and Adán Griego, how does he figure in here in terms of, the images that have been put together from the two libraries?
John Reed is a very important character. He's probably best known to American audiences for the movie Reds that Warren Beatty did in the 1970s, I believe. John Reed was a young reporter that worked for Metropolitan Magazine and was sent to Mexico to report on Pancho Villa's troops, and he was embedded there for 4 months. And when he came back, he wrote several articles that really on Pancho Villa that gained him the equivalent of rock star status nowadays. In 1914, his book Insurgent Mexico was published, that gave him even more fame. And then he went to Europe, where we probably recognize him from his other book, 10 Days That Shook the World, his experience in Russia, where he died, I believe, in the 1920s. And he's a very important figure because he gave an image of Pancho Villa as a kind of Robin Hood character, stealing from the rich to help the poor. And Pancho Villa was a very well-known figure in American circles at that point. Pancho Villa had also signed contracts with the very beginnings of the Hollywood film industry, where he would stage his battles for Ready for the Camera. So Hollywood, early Hollywood, and John Reed contributed to portraying an image of Pancho Villa that became very popular in the United States, which, of course, all of that changed when Pancho Villa invaded Columbus, New Mexico in 1916.
Now, I'm looking at some responses that came to us via email from our listeners, and Professor Velasco had just mentioned Elena Poniatowska, not a very Mexican-sounding name, of course. And a listener, Isabel, says, please don't forget to mention Hasta No Verte Mas Jesus Mio by Elena Poniatowski, fictionalized biography of a soldadera, and also mentions, don't forget, Rain of Gold, other wonderful Chicano literature. Here's Lisa, who says, thank you for this discussion. September 16th is my birthday, so as a Mexican-American, I've always been proud of that. Yet no one knows what the significance of this date is. Please talk about the difference between Cinco de Mayo and September 16th.
I think it's very important that American audiences tend to confuse Cinco de Mayo as Mexican Independence Day. Cinco de Mayo is the commemoration of the Mexican troops defeating the French invading troops on May 5th in 1862. And it's very important because the Mexican troops were not the best equipped of the period, and the French troops of Bonaparte were sadly one of the best armies in Europe. So it's very symbolic that even though the French eventually invaded Mexico and installed a foreign emperor, Maximilian, for several years, the Mexicans did win the Battle of Cinco de Mayo under the leadership of General Ignacio Zaragoza. The other thing that we tend to get confused is that the Grito festivities have traditionally taken place on September 15th, when the actual battle cry of Father Dolores was on September 16th. And there's a reason for that. There's a man that ruled most of Mexico in the 19th century. For 34 years, Porfirio Diaz ruled with an iron hand, and he was overthrown in 1910. And Porfirio Diaz's birthday was on September 15th. So in some ways, he sort of sequestered the revolution, the Feast of Independence, for his birthday. And the traditional grito was given on the night of September 15th. It continues to be given pretty close to midnight, so that it's already September 16th, when Father Hidalgo rang the church bells in the small town of Dolores.
That was the call to arms, basically, on September 16th. Yeah, I'm actually looking at an email here from a listener named Al, who says, on a visit to the Revolutionary Museum in Mexico City, I look for photos of my number one revolutionary hero, Zapata. There was but one. I asked the docent why, and she said, politics. Funny note to end on, but we have come to the end of this program, and I just want to mention that the Celebrating Mexico exhibit opened at the University of California, Berkeley's Bancroft Library on September 2nd. You can go see it, and the parallel exhibit opens on the 20th of September at Stanford University's Cecil H. Green Library. I want to extend thanks to both Juan Velasco, Associate Professor of English at Santa Clara University, who will be giving a lecture on the novels of the Mexican Revolution as part of Shared Heritage, Mexico and California 200 Years Program, and to Adan Griego, who is curator for Latin American, Mexican American, and Iberian collections at Stanford and co-curated the new exhibit Celebrating Mexico, the Grito de Dolores and the Mexican Revolution. Thank you both for being with us on Forum. Thank you, our listeners. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.